From KPFK Pacifica Radio, this is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. You can watch this program on Free Speech TV and listen to it on Pacifica radio stations and affiliates nationwide. The coronavirus pandemic exposed the fault lines of capitalism like no other crisis in recent memory, prompting millions of Americans to reevaluate the role of government as prioritizing public well-being. But already there was a growing movement afoot in the U.S. of democratic socialism, as symbolized in the presidential candidacy of Senator Bernie Sanders and the election to Congress of young, openly socialist lawmakers. Writing a new book about this moment is my guest, John Judis. He's an editor-at-large at Talking Points Memo. He writes for The New Republic, The American Prospect, and others, and is the author of The Socialist Awakening, What's Different Now About the Left. His earlier books include The Nationalist Revival and The Populist Explosion. Welcome to the program, John.
Glad to be with you.
So, as I mentioned, capitalism very much has been exposed as being a system that cannot handle a crisis like the pandemic we are in. But even before 2020, why did we see so much interest, especially among young people, around the ideas of socialism?
Well, I think there were a few things that happened. The most important is the Great Recession. I think that turned a lot of young people, at least become skeptical about capitalism. And it started showing up in these polls and amazed me as someone who was a socialist in the 60s and just gave up at some point. Where you'd see a polling saying, 50% of people 18 to 29 had a favorable view of socialism and only 46% of capitalism. So that was really surprising to me. And I think the biggest factor was the Great Recession. Climate change, I think, was another big factor. I think that for people growing up now, it has a kind of similar effect that the threat of nuclear war had for us in the 1950s, when we have to hide under our desks to practice air raid drills. It's not that immediate for me, that climate change, but I think the threat is much more immediate. And it's something that's understood that if you just leave it to the oil companies, if you leave it to the energy industries, then nothing's going to get done. And in 20 or 30 years, we're going to be in an immense trouble. So those two things, I think, led to a skepticism about capitalism. I guess one other thing. Mm-hmm. Let me add one other thing. The other thing was, I think that for previous generations, again, people who came of age in the 50s, 60s, or even before that, if they didn't go to college, they could look to pretty secure employment. A lot of it blue collar, a lot of it taking the jobs that their parents had before. Again, this is a time when kids start going to college in large numbers. It's about 4 or 5% after World War II. It becomes like 25% by 1970s. Again, looking forward to jobs. In a way that is almost incomprehensible now for the generations that come of age in the early 2000s, and really see a much bleaker prospect than I saw in the early 1960s. So I think, again, even leaving aside the Great Recession, those factors were important in making people skeptical about capitalism.
If you listen to proponents of capitalism, America has always been a, vehemently and proudly capitalist country. But of course, there's always been undercurrents of support for socialism. And indeed, we have in place programs that can be described only as socialism. And before there was Bernie Sanders, there was Eugene Debs. Tell me about Debs and how he figures into that historical arc of American support for socialism.
Eugene Debs from Terre Haute, Indiana, a mid-sized town that probably voted for Trump in the last election. And was at the time of a center of the social gospel, the Protestant social gospel, the idea that Christians should try to create a kingdom of God on earth. Deb's very much influenced by that. And at one point in his life says that Jesus is a more important mentor to him than Marx. So that again, that's an important element for him. He goes into he's a fireman on trains, and he goes into the union and becomes an official of the craft union at the time. The train fireman, every little job was divided up into different craft unions. The conductors, the engineers, they all had different unions. At that point, very much anti the idea of strikes or anything like that. But the United States in the 1880s and 1890s goes through this immense period of labor unrest. And Debs gets involved in a union called the American Railway Union that tries to unite all these crafts. And they get crushed in a strike against the Pullman, which at the time, I don't think they call them this anymore, but they were the people who did sleeping cars for railroads. And it was a huge industry. And Debs' union got beat. Debs ended up going to jail. And when he was in jail, he started reading about socialism and Marx. And that's when he became a socialist. And the idea that Debs had, which I think, again, has proven to be limited in many ways, is that you weren't going to be able to have unions, you weren't going to be able to have unemployment insurance, you weren't going to have old age insurance or anything like that without socialism. For Debs, really, socialism was a kind of make or break politics. In that sense, very different from Bernie Sanders and what Bernie Sanders talked about as democratic socialism, much of which can happen within capitalism. So the two big things about Debs, and the thing that carries over and is very much part of socialists today, is the, you say, Christian, or if you want to leave aside that, the particular religion, ethical idea of socialism, people cooperating together rather than competing. I mean, part of the problem we're having in the pandemic, and that I really didn't expect. I thought that this pandemic would bring Americans together, but again, it's brought people apart. And I think a lot of that is Trump, but I think a lot of it, again, is built into differences among the regions in the country and into American individualism. So again, socialism ethically, very much opposed to that, seeing the idea of cooperation, of caring for others as an essential part of politics. So again, put that together with Bernie Sanders' idea of democratic socialism, taking those parts of the economy that aren't working, like the healthcare industry, and putting them under public control, but still retaining private property, still people would own their own homes, and there would be private companies and a market that would figure out whether people needed things or not.
Now, during the election campaign, Republicans and Trump relentlessly demonized the idea of socialism, called Joe Biden a socialist, even though he very clearly distinguished himself from Bernie Sanders and is an avowed capitalist. How much of a misunderstanding of what socialism is continues to drive American capitalism, and you know, the role of propaganda?
Well, let me say two things about it. The first thing is that it's a generational problem. People who grew up during the Cold War associate socialism with the Soviet Union. And if they came, if they're emigres from Latin America, from Cuba, Venezuela, Colombia, they associate it with Cuba, or they associate it with Venezuela. They don't associate it with democracy. So I think for a lot of people who are, let's say, older than 40 or 45, socialism's a bad thing, period. And it shows up that way in the polls. There's this incredible break at about age 40 or 45 if you look at people's opinions about socialism. The other thing is that, you know, there still are big differences in the country, and it's between Republicans and Democrats about how big a role the private sectors can play and how big a role the public sector can play in our economy, whether we should have more public control of healthcare, of transportation, and of energy. Whether the government should encourage rather than discourage labor unions, for instance, which again is a kind of proto-socialism. It's giving workers more power over their jobs. So that, you know, that's a real difference in the society. And if you left aside the Cold War identification of socialism with some kind of tyranny, you'd still have a battle on our hands. But I think it would look a lot different. It would look more like Europe than the United States now. So, you know, I believe Abigail Spanberger and the various congressmen and congresswomen who said that they had a lot of problems with both defund the police and socialism in their districts. Because, you know, again, the median age of the voter in America is about 50. So, you know, put it all together. So, again, if we're going to think about socialism in the future, I think we have to do two things. First of all, we have to be patient and build a movement, but again, be very tolerant of different kinds of programs that might fit into a socialist politics, but don't have the name socialism attached to them. And again, you know, let's say somebody like Elizabeth Warren, I don't think there was a lot of difference between her and Bernie Sanders. You know, people found differences and they, you know, they had certain changes, but
well, she made it clear she was an avowed capitalist, and I think that rankled a lot
of course,
people.
That's so. Right. But she was again ran in a state where it would have caused her problems if she said otherwise. So there's a lot of people who advocate things that are consistent with democratic socialism, but don't call themselves socialist. And that's one thing I think that people who like the name have to recognize, and that the various groups that are call themselves socialists have to understand that we're going to, you know, that if we get to a better society, one where workers have more power over their lives, where the industries that aren't working begin working because they're better regulated or nationalized or whatever, we're going to have to accept that a lot of people who advocate those things aren't going to call them socialist.
What about the UK? You contrast in your book the movement for socialism in the US and UK. What has the trajectory there been different?
Well, it has to be different because socialism was never that much of a dirty word there. They, you know, the Labour Party became officially socialist in 1918. I mean, Europe is different in that respect than the United States. So it's a question of there of what socialism meant. The Labour Party in the UK had very similar problems to the Democratic Party here, which is that it had an older constituency, in their case, again, based in mining and manufacturing, outside the big metro areas, outside, obviously, the university towns, kind of Cambridge, Oxford, what have you, and that they began to hemorrhage support within those old mining and manufacturing areas, and to become a party primarily of the more cosmopolitan, younger, highly educated people. Similar, again, to something that's happened in the Democratic Party in the United States. So there was a kind of regional geographical split. And Brexit in Britain really brought it to the surface because, again, if you look at the support for Brexit, it came primarily, again, from, on the one hand, Tories, conservatives, small business, whatever, but a lot of working class labor voters from these towns that had been deindustrialized in the 80s and 90s and early 2000s. So by by taking a very ambiguous position on Brexit, the Labour Party separated itself off from that constituency and lost a lot of the votes that it always had. And that was a big reason why it got routed in December of 2019.
In the UK, is a growing interest in socialism also being driven by a younger generation, as we see in the US?
Very similar, yes. Momentum was the name of the group within the Labour Party. And while it had a few old farts like me in it, it was primarily younger people, 20s and 30s, and primarily college educated.
Now we know
very much based in the big cities.
Now there are these broad trends that as people age, they tend to get more conservative. I'm wondering if you think that the socialist chapter in the U.S. can start if more young people get involved, you know, become active, not just in grassroots organizing, but in actually voting in elections and lower the average age of the typical voter, or are we going to have to wait for them to age up and become more involved, by which time they might not be as socialist as they are now?
Yeah. What the saying used to be, if you're not a socialist when you're 25 years old, you have no heart, and if you still are when you're 40, you have no head, something like that. we'll have to see. I mean, my view is that the country faces problems that are going to require a greater involvement of the public sector. And, you know, you can see it obviously with the pandemic and recession that are going on now. We're going to have to think about whether we want to encourage certain industries. There's going to be a more conservative way to do that. And you could see that in some of the Republicans now, like Marco Rubio from Florida, who, you know, to my surprise, are talking about having the government having an industrial policy, which is something that Democrats used to talk about in the early 1980s, where we encourage certain industries and, if necessary, protect them from foreign competition. So, again, I think something like that's going to happen. Is it going to happen along with a revival of the labor movement, of organization from below? I think that's the big question, not just for socialists, but for the left. Because the problem we have right now is that, you know, the Democratic Party's strength used to lie in its base, a large part of which was organized labor. You know, a third of non-farm families in the 1950s. That's gone. And it's because of that, I think, that's a big reason why we're getting beaten so badly in local and state elections. Because that was that's what helped politically to drive a Democratic votes in those kind of elections. Now the Republicans have had, you know, the Koch brothers, they had the religious right, televangelists, they had gun clubs, etc. So again, the question is going to be, can we rebuild that power from below? And, you know, you see elements of it now, but it's not really organized. And until we have that, it's going to be hard to get things across. Also, I think that's a way to break the age barrier, too.
Your book, The Socialist Awakening, that we're discussing, is part of a trilogy that includes two earlier books, The Nationalist Revival and The Populist Explosion. What's the link between socialism, nationalism, and populism that we need to understand?
Well, first, populism. Populism, you see it both on the left and the right. It's a politics that speaks on behalf of the people against an elite or an establishment. And I think you find that on the left and amongst people who also describe themselves as socialists, because the older Marxist ideas about the working class don't really apply anymore the way they used to. They used to be a very homogeneous industrial working class. And in the late 19th century, early 20th century, people really believed that they would become 60, 70% of the country, that there would be this huge industrial working class. And then you'd have some small business and then some capitalists at the top, and they would either vote themselves into office and socialism, or there would be a revolution. That was kind of the vision of the working class. But, you know, if you look at the people who work for wage or salary in the United States, they're so deeply divided by status, race, nationality, the kinds of jobs people have, that it becomes easier to talk about working people or to organize the people. So populist themes have become very important and linked to socialist themes, as well as on the right, where you see the same kind of people versus the elite, but you also see the accusation that the elites are coddling this third group, African Americans, illegal immigrants, Muslims, what have you. So again, populism is an important politics for our era, and for the left, it's important because you can't clearly talk anymore about the working class. So that's the populist socialist connection.
Well, what challenges do you foresee for the Democratic Party going forward, seeing as it's a party that recently, you know, in the last two elections, has faced a challenge from a socialist, Bernie Sanders, has seen it's a loss in popularity in part because so many people see a disconnect between the party's stated ideology and its actual practices. And also this new crop of very successful, outspoken, charismatic, and deeply popular young people of color, mostly women even, who are proud socialists, who are getting elected. It seems as though there's this generational split within the Democratic Party that reflects a bit the generational split in the nation as well. And how the party navigates that in a Biden administration going forward is going to be, I think, critical to its own future, right?
Well, look, you're talking about really two things. The biggest problem the Democrats have is somehow connecting their voters in these big metropolitan areas who have certain cultural values with the voters in small towns and mid-sized towns, many of whom used to be Democrats. And the way our electoral system is set up constitutionally, by giving, fairly unpopulated, less populated states equal power in terms of the Senate, let's say Wyoming, Utah, et cetera. Democrats are going to have to do that if they want to keep majorities in Congress and the White House. And you can't really do anything these days. I think Biden's just going to have a hell of a time doing anything if the Republicans control the Senate. And, you know, I think it's like, 3-2 that they will win at least one of those races in Georgia. So a lot of the problem, Democrats, is how to put together the different parts of the country, how to breach this regional divide. Within the party itself, again, I think the progressive left wing, represented, let's say, by Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, is going to be sidelined by especially if the Republicans maintain control of the Senate, because the House of Representatives could pass a bill to nationalize all the oil companies, and it would never even get to a committee in the Senate. So again, I think that they're going to have to look toward the future, towards 2022, 2024, and it's going to be very difficult for them to have a lot of influence. And then I fear that's going to be the situation in the next 2 years and maybe the next 4 years with Biden. It's going to be a matter of maneuvering and trying to get Americans the kind of help, very basic help, they're going to need to stem the virus and to rebuild the economy.
Well, finally, I'm wondering if you have any advice also to give to young folks about getting involved. There's a number of ways in which they could press the Biden administration on issues like college debt, on climate change, on healthcare. But it certainly, you know, I think our electorate requires a very deep involvement from those, you know, folks whose future is being written.
Well, look, we were talking about divisions within elected officials. The Biden administration is going to be able to do a lot of things on its own through the executive branch. And I think, again, in those respects, issues about climate change, labor, getting good people on the National Labor Relations Board, paying attention to occupational health and safety, things like that are really important issues. And, you know, again, I think people can pressure them. But I hesitate to advise people what to do, since I spent 7 years or so of my life trying to create a revolution and ended up getting Ronald Reagan. So it's but you know, the main thing is, again, think local and state. Think about building organization there. For the moment, let's say a socialist organization isn't going to have that much influence on who's going to be president. I thought it was obvious to support Biden in that case, but again, I don't think it would have made that much difference. But local elections do make a lot of difference, and groups that are organized can make a lot of difference to what happens.
I want to thank you so much, John, for joining us today. Good luck with the book.
My pleasure. Bye.
My guest has been John Judas. He is an editor at large at Talking Points Memo and writes for numerous publications, including The New Republic. His earlier books include The Nationalist Revival and The Populist Explosion. We've been discussing his latest book called The Socialist Awakening. The subtitle is What's Different Now About the Left? I'm Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com, where you can sign up for our daily newsletter. You can find our audio podcast on iTunes and Spotify.